And they actually told me that they had aided in the creation of humankind using something similar to test tubes.
Hello, this is Wendy's Coffee House. I'm Wendy. My guest, John Foster. In this segment, the UFO influence on animals. He started telling his story in the 90s. His reality includes being involved with clandestine UFO contact for almost 5 decades. Some of that involved teaching him how to design a certain piece of equipment that he isn't at liberty to discuss. If you read John's books and go to johnfosterufos.com, you'll find out more of the story. We talked about in the earlier segment the types of beings he has seen in the craft, also him piloting a craft. Do you believe in an afterlife?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the one big proof is the Dillon Lake experience in 1975, where my daughter, my son, and I had an out-of-body experience out over the lake, over the water. She remembers some of what I remember, and she remembers the voice speaking that, telling us that we had to go back. We had to go back. She remembers seeing my body. I can't recall if she remembers seeing hers when we went back and approached the shore. But I remember seeing my body standing there. And of course, before I left, I saw my body standing there. And I was told that that was me. That was my body. When we were out of body, which means that we have a spiritual body and we could communicate, we could talk back and forth to each other, but we couldn't see each other. And we couldn't see, they had a voice that took charge of them and dealt with them, and I had a voice that took charge of me, and we all met out in the middle of the lake, and several things happened and so forth. And I think that's chapter 6 in Imminent Discovery, volume 1.
When you were in large groups and there were other people there, there were times when everyone would be frozen.
Yeah, the Bethany Grade School playground encounter would be a good example of that. There would be times when the entire crowd was frozen. There would be times when only, say, 2 or 3 or 4 of us were moving and understanding what was going on. And there would be other times when the crowd was not frozen and they were seeing the craft, for instance, like at the football game, the Nebraska football game. And they would point, the craft manifested out of a fog or a cloud that was really close to the heads of the crowd that was probably 100 feet away from me in the corner of the stadium. It was the dish-shaped craft, one of the dish-shaped craft with the 2 headlights. They would point at it, and there was a big roar over there. It was like they were cheering during the game, but there was no action on the field. And then the craft flew about 9 feet, maybe 6 to 9 feet over the heads of people. The craft came right in front of us, about maybe 10 to 20 feet in front of us. And we saw people pointing at it and talking about it. And then it turned, and when it was a little bit to our right and ahead of us, it turned and flew right straight up over the stadium, over the heads, maybe 10 feet over the heads of people, and disappeared over the top of the stadium. Well, then when we left the game, we heard a guy talking about it. And so we stopped and talked to him and about it and what he saw and what we saw. And we figured there would be an article in a newspaper. We looked, there was no article in the newspaper. So how do you figure that? That means, of course, mind control, I think. And that was done a lot. And different situations with different number of people involved. I think I had one other encounter that might be a good example of that. My sisters, they must have been involved in hundreds of short encounters. My one sister was at the Bethany Grade School. She doesn't remember a thing about it, and she gets angry every time I bring up UFOs. She's a fundamental Christian and believes it's satanic. And my other sister really doesn't want to talk about it, but it means nothing to her. But the one sister was there. She heard the boyfriend she was with and I were involved personally. And she was either unconscious it was over 2 hours. The whole time she was unconscious, or she was programmed not to remember. You know what mm-hmm. I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then, for instance, when I was a senior, I was helping a friend out with the lights on a school entertainment program. And, you know, where people would sing or there would be a little band playing and or there would be a guy step up and tell jokes and variety program.
Yeah.
After the last band played, I noticed a dark clouds churning above the stage. And before the band left the stage, there was even a low roar to it. And they all got up and they left. And then the curtains closed and the cloud came out in front of the curtains. And it was up high towards the ceiling. And it churned. I think it was before that or before the band played, there was a guy giving a comedian type routine. And there was a booth that developed right beside him. It was not more than 7 feet away, maybe 8 feet. And the voice started interrupting his comedy act. He would stop and he would look at it. Finally, he went to the edge of the stage and he motioned for the director, who was a teacher. This was high school, senior year. And she came over and talked to him. I didn't hear what they said, but she told him to go back and finish. The booth sat there until he finished, and then the curtain closed. Okay, now, figure that out.
Yeah. Okay, I'm guessing very few people could see that interaction.
Well, I don't know. Was the entire crowd frozen, or the teacher wasn't frozen? My friend didn't see it because he didn't mention anything about it. He almost had to have seen the cloud churning in front of the curtains. He was in the light booth. You know, we were in the back of the seats up high in the balcony. And, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
It's a controlled thing. So now we can get into what that means. There's a subtle control going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we can get into all of that if you want to.
Go ahead. Yeah. You know, you have people present who are witnessing it and others who have absolutely no awareness. When you're trying to prove something, it's impossible.
Okay. Well, then if you go back to the first encounters I had where they told me they were here to change humankind, well, you can figure that I was about 3 years old. You can stop and think about it. And you could say, okay, were they here before I was born? Or was this their start of them changing humankind? You know, am I the first one or am I not the first one? Well, it's pretty obvious I wasn't the first one.
I'm sorry. That's a blow to the ego, isn't it?
Right. I could be Christ, right? In other words, it goes way back to the creation of humankind. They actually told me that they had aided in the creation of humankind using something similar to test tubes, and that they have nurtured us throughout the ages. And this included the brotherhoods. There were several different brotherhoods. For instance, I was, during several encounters, I was given in extreme detail how to develop a certain invention. During the Sheridan Creek Fireguarding encounter, which is chapter 9 in the first chapter in volume 2, of Imminent Discovery. There was one episode in there where my friend and I met historical inventors who had invented certain things. And there was a old man with a beard that came out, and my friend was giving him trouble, and he always thought they were evil and that sort of thing. And so the old man chewed us out, and he said this was a brotherhood and that of inventors, and that we needed to learn and remember the name of the blood brotherhood. And it spelled it out in the midair right above the inventors who were lined up in a row, half of them at a table exhibiting their invention and half of them on the ground exhibiting their inventions. There was a bigger physical device of some kind. Well, they spent lengthy amount of time with the one inventor who explained that he was the inventor of the dies for General Motors cars and so forth and so on. And the story goes on. And let's see, that story is chapter 9, of Imminent Discovery, volume 2. I was at the Sheridan Creek Fire Guard Cabin when that happened. And then later, a few days later, or several days later, we had a time travel to eastern Nebraska, and we were shown the project and so forth. But eventually, I resigned as a fire guard. That was at a fire guard cabin for the U.S. Forest Service. We were working as fire guards. And a friend in Dubois, Wyoming, was working with a rancher who took care of dudes and gave horse rides to dudes, and he had a herd of horses. He had to fire the wrangler, and this friend told me that I could be the wrangler there. He knew the owner fairly well, and he was kind of a friend, and he would give me recommendations. So, and he said he would teach me how to break and train horses. Mm-hmm. Well, I had worked with horses in Nebraska, and so I knew a little bit about it. And I also, the year before, had wrangled horses with to skid logs down the mountain at a logging camp in the wilderness. So I became the wrangler. And later that summer, during one day, there was two women that showed up with a young girl who was a teenager, about my age. And the owner wanted me to meet the young girl because he was interested in business with the two ladies. So they introduced us, and come to find out, her father, he was divorced from her mother, but he was the designer and creator of the dies for General Motors cars. So
interesting.
That tells you something. What does that tell you?
The connection. The connection.
Yeah, there was a connection. And so everything is somewhat connected, you might say. Different people are connected. After I had all my recollections and I met the familiar strangers in Nebraska here, and we started the project, we had unbelievable coincidental happenings.
Did you notice a different response around animals?
When the craft showed up, the animals definitely knew it. They would shy away, or we had one horse at the ranch who would almost fall to the ground when the craft manifested. They couldn't figure it out. They figured she had a brain problem. It was a mare, and she had two wonderful, good-looking colts. This one day, the friend that had gotten me the job and another fella and I wanted to take her out and see if we could figure out what was wrong with her, because nothing really made sense. And so we went for a ride. We came across the highway, came back again, and approached the ditch on the north side of the highway, and this horse started to buckle her front feet, and she almost fell to the ground. Well, I noticed, and also the guy who got me the job, my friend, noticed that there was a hissing and roaring in front of her and a distortion of the atmosphere in the ditch. When she was looking at it, she was drawn towards it, her knees buckled, and she fell to the ground on her front knees.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't figure it out. And then later we had a doctor and his wife wanting to take a ride. So my boss insisted he befriended them, and he was sort of friendly, and he wanted me to really take care of them, okay, mm-hmm. make sure they had a good time and so forth. And so we went out on a ride, and she insisted that she ride this mare. And we tried to talk her out of it because she wouldn't take no for an answer. And so we put her on the mare, and we went across the river, and we approached sort of a small hill real close. And this distortion in the atmosphere happened again. And I remember seeing a craft starting to manifest. The mare, her front legs buckled, and she fell sideways on the woman and broke her ankle. And then, of course, the craft took off, and we didn't see it after that. And so he had to send her to the hospital, which was 80 miles away.
Okay,
anyway,
okay.
They're all interesting stories.
Was there any follow-up with that woman? Because to me, that was intentional.
No, there was not a follow-up. They were pretty angry. As far as I know, the boss never heard from him again. He paid their medical expenses.
It's too coincidental that the horse was going to have the problem and the woman demanded to be on that horse and then the craft shows up.
Yeah,
it's just,
right.
To me, they don't seem to make mistakes, okay?
You know, when the daughter of the guy who developed the dyes for General Motors cars, they insisted I take her out on a midnight ride. You know, we got along pretty good, and I was kind of, I don't know what you call it, when a guy kind of falls for a girl.
Smitten.
Yeah, smitten, maybe. Anyway, we went across the highway. Actually, it was where we had taken the mare, and we went up on a little bluff, and we were kind of talking there, and she was talking about her dad and so forth, and a craft showed up. And she got scared. So we had another mare who had digestive problems. She was all plugged up. And this was another time when this gal insisted that she ride this particular horse. Mm-hmm. We said no, but she wouldn't take no for an answer. So we went back then to the ranch and we didn't get along because of the UFO showing up.
John Foster, Wendy's Coffee House. We continue with the story. The UFO showed up, which didn't guarantee a first date or a second encounter.
They left the next morning suddenly, but then she wrote me a note and she wrote me a letter. I quit that summer, came back to Lincoln. I wrote her some letters.
I think somebody intervened in your relationship, John.
I think so. Well, the next thing, you know, I hesitate praying sometimes because weird things happen, but I prayed really hard at that time. Well, we knew we wouldn't probably get along, and I prayed really hard that I could meet somebody that I could share life with that was completely honest and wholesome and so forth. And so not too long after that, I met Annie, and we just sort of hit it off and so forth.
Yeah, see? Okay.
And I was telling about this girl whose father was really rich, and she was prettier than Annie was. And, of course, that was an insult with it to Annie. And, of course, Annie has a kind of a big mouth sometimes. She tells you what she thinks. She said, well, I'll tell you what, you and I are not going any further until you go up and get this girl out of your system. So she helped me pick out a suitcase and she sent me off on the train. And I didn't have any money. And my dad was chief of the state fisheries and he and my mom were going to go to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania for a fisheries, national fisheries convention. And so we made arrangements for him to pick me up in Chicago, where this gal and her mother lived. So I went on the train and I got to Chicago and we didn't get along that well and so forth and knew it wouldn't work. Anyway, my folks picked me up, went to Philadelphia, and I couldn't wait to get back home and see Annie, and I was going to ask her to marry me and so forth, although I didn't tell her at that time. And there's nothing to do with UFOs, but I made my folks' trip miserable because I was wanting to get back. And we primarily toured the East Coast, Washington, D.C., went up as far as Maine, went into Canada, saw part of Canada, came down through the falls in, what do you call them?
Niagara Falls?
Niagara Falls. And then on back home, okay? And then, of course, as you know, then we got married and had three kids and so forth.
And you've been married how many years now?
Well, it's been 60-some-odd years, 64 years, I think.
Okay. So Annie knew what she was talking about.
She did. Now, she normally does, but we argue. We got started arguing every day the first time we met, and we've argued ever since. But we're almost completely honest about everything.
That's why you said you were scared to pray, because you get what you ask for.
It's interesting. My life has been, one of your questions was, has my life been destined,
guided,
controlled,
guided
to the extreme Figure the invention I was given. I worked at the Hallam Nuclear Plant here in Lincoln after we were married, and it was the first of its kind nuclear reactor for power. There were certain things that were wrong with their design and their procedures and so forth, and I picked them out and I spoke out honestly about it, and they warned me if I didn't shut up that they would fire me. So I kind of cut it down, but I still brought those points up, and there were where the problems were and so forth. And then they asked me to go to California to work on a nuclear satellite, well, first of its kind. While I was there, the reactor here in Lincoln, or near Lincoln, melted down. One of the problems was that uranium-235 takes, once it's radioactive, it takes 35,000 years to decay where it's safe. And of course, everything, the cooling water and the sodium, which was a coolant for the reactor and so forth, all of that is still there someplace, and it'll take 35,000 years for that to decay where it's not harmful to humans.
Your involvement with that nuclear stuff. Yeah. I mean, that's crucial.
And then the project in California, I didn't have a degree, but they finally advanced me to engineer in charge of the environmental testing laboratory for the satellite, even though we didn't test we tested the reactor, but it wasn't when it was radioactive. Other groups tested when it was radioactive. Eventually, they launched the satellite and put it in orbit from Vandenberg Air Force Base. The name of it was SNAP-10 or SNAP-10A, if the listeners are interested in looking it up. But anyway, they took us down to a secret compound at headquarters in San Fernando Valley, and while it was being launched, and then off and on the week after, a couple of weeks after. And they took us down this last time, and they said the reactor had shut down mysteriously, and they didn't know why. And then they finally admitted that there were small spheres that were moving around the reactor core in an intelligent manner, and they figured that it was ET interference. Then there were other things I was involved with that put me in a key place where I did some smart things and sometimes stupid things that would change the outcome of that particular project. That tells you that if you analyze the evidence in the Bible, in all kinds of ancient historical writings, people dealt with entities that were mysterious, and you note the characteristics of the interaction and so forth, and all the way up through history to the present day, and you almost have to admit that what we are experiencing today is what they experienced back then. Possibly different, because humans have made progress, and you know, we know more about science and so forth.
Donald Ware, this is one of the most important stories that UFO experiencers have to offer. I think he was inspired to write To Earth from Heaven for our benefit, for the benefit of all truth seekers. That's an incredible and really important endorsement. It was great to see that.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Yeah, Donald was actually one of the guys, he and Wendell Stevens, who was a recent UFO researcher since the 1940s, I gave a talk at a national talk, which was somewhat international, at the Ozark UFO conference in the year 2000. He and Wendell were there, and after I got done, they insisted that I do a talk at the 2001 International UFO Conference Convention. So if you go on my website and you scroll down a little bit, you'll find the UFOs at the Core of Our Culture, which was the title of my talk. Donald was the one that introduced me for that lecture at the convention. And then he has his own experiences. He was a Navy pilot. He was in on the development of nuclear power during his careers. And anyway, that's covered in Appendix A in Imminent Discovery, Volume 2. And Wendell's also are there. I don't feel I'm any better, any more important than anybody else, and I think everybody has their own niche to this. The story is the creation of humans and the nurturing throughout the ages. God is involved, and God is an extraterrestrial plus. It is a terrestrial also. What they're interested in is the development of the human species, and particularly the development of individuals, which includes yourself and myself and everybody else. Your development depends on what your motives are, and you learning as you were from the time you're born until you get older, you develop certain things that are original. Nobody else has thought about, nobody has ever done, and you become a unique entity before you die. And then of course, after you die. So it's just the nature for me, it explains the nature of life, that it's really special. And we as a culture are gradually understanding what's happening. You're right on target. You, with a couple of other gals, I don't know why it's gals, have hit the nail right on the head. And you, almost everything you say is absolutely, I would back 100%. And there's a couple other gals, and then of course other guys too. Guys, for some reason, have a more difficult time. But women also, there's a lot of women that don't want to get into it at all, like my wife. She doesn't even like to hear about it, but she spent hours and days and months and years listening to me, and she's not interested, actually, but she's so kind to do that. The one fella that really made me feel good early on was Bob Teach. He was a former representative for the Human Potential Foundation, which was a foundation headed by one, I can't think of the senator's name, but it was set up to keep President Clinton informed of the developments of new science and also new developments in the UFO field. He was sent out to, they were thinking that the Human Potential Foundation would write my story in a book and that Bob would be the editor and the writer and the editor and publish it. They sent him out to Leo Sprinkle's conference in Laramie. I believe that was around 1990. He just kind of latched on to me, and I didn't know why. This is probably a good time to tell the story about the South African drawing that a tribesman did, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Bob was sitting next to me, and Annie was on the other side, and the reporter from South Africa was giving the lecture, and she said that she found out a tribe out in the bush had had a UFO encounter, and so she went out and interviewed especially this one tribesman, and she was talking to him, and he said, well, do you want to see what I saw? And she said, yeah. And so he went and got a piece of charcoal and he drew a picture on the on a piece of paper or piece of wood. And he said, this is what I saw. And so when she was giving the talk in Laramie, she said, and this is what he drew. And she put the drawing up on the overhead screen. And I had just handed Bob a stack of 30 to 50 drawings. And he looked at her drawing, and he looked down in his hand, and it was the exact same picture, he said, that I had drawn of what I saw. And it was of the winged saucer, and he said the drawings were identical. Even the shading was identical. And then Bob wrote an accolade for my book. What he wrote was just overwhelmingly outstanding. I'm very humbled by what he wrote. He had made, eventually had made investigations of UFO experiencers all around the U.S. And he had interviewed over 3,000 people. And he said, by far, my story was, you'll have to read it.
I'm going to read it. Okay. This is Bob Teets, author, investigative journalist, researcher, editor, publisher, former representative of the Human Potential Foundation. And the senator you were thinking of, this was founded in 1989 by C.B. Scott Jones and Senator Claiborne Pell. Funding provided by Lawrence Rockefeller and or Pell. All right, so it was dissolved in 1998. Bob Teat said, "It was truly the start of an adrenaline rush that would propel me through several years of UFO research and interviews with some 3,000 experiencers all over the country. None would be so intriguing, so absolutely riveting, bizarre, far out, instructive, challenging, and representative of the entire UFO phenomenon as John Foster's incredible story." So that is outstanding.
If it wasn't for Bob, I would have maybe committed suicide, or I would have not. I would have flipped, maybe.
I don't know that anyone can fathom how disruptive, how mind-blowing it throws you into an entirely different universe than what we're used to.
Yeah, and even now, I kind of tear up sometimes. And it's a positive, but in many ways it's a negative. But you have to remember that even Christ was accused of working for the devil or being the devil himself.
As Bob Teat says, this is one of the most incredible stories that ticks all the boxes when it comes to UFO contact. JohnFosterUFOs.com, almost 50 years of clandestine involvement where he was groomed, educated, trained. I'll put the links in the description for the show. We'll do another segment with John. Thanks for listening. Stay curious.